Hey, it's Joe. Today, we're going to learn some amazing tips for becoming a stronger and more efficient cyclist based on science. Let me start by saying that I love riding my bike. After actually saying out loud in ignorance that cycling was too stupid and boring for a climber and skier like me, I finally tried it 10 years ago and fell in love. The bike-rider combination is a magical thing that makes my life better as well as makes me a healthier human. Oh, if only we actually knew more science about how to make the bike-human connection better. Yes, it's true that us cyclists love to argue about crank length and saddle height and the optimal pedaling technique and which cadence is best, as if we weren't actually merely repeating the baseless things we read in a magazine or heard at the coffee shop. But Professor Jim Martin, professor of nutrition and integrative physiology at the University of Utah, who is of course a longtime track and road cyclist, Dr. Martin has spent the last 30 years researching cyclic biomechanics and physiology to understand basic neuromuscular function all the way to human performance on a bike. So here we go. Listen in as Dr. Martin explains, does crank length matter? If so, for what? Is there an optimal cadence in RPMs? Is there an optimal pedaling technique for maximum power or maximum endurance? In other words, how can I coordinate my application of my leg muscles in applying force to the pedals? Is there a better way? If there is a better way, can I get my body to use that way? And lastly, what are Jim's training tips for getting the most out of our efforts on the bike? Let me tell you, these tips are gold. All right, let's talk to Dr. Jim Martin. Jim Martin, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Good to be here.
Yeah. Where are you calling in from?
Salt Lake City, Utah.
Hoo-hoo. It's like a bitter Arctic cold there now. Is that right?
It should be, but it's actually... it's cycling weather right now. It's in the 50s,
awesome, and we're up
in the canyon pretty high. So yeah, it's a strange winter.
Yeah. I'm here in the Asheville, North Carolina area, and we're like 10 degrees above normal. It's interesting times. So no white Christmas for us. All right. Well, hey, as you know, I've been trying to get you on the show for a while. You're the guy. You've got all this knowledge. You're like this weird. I don't even know. I assume that they're paying you to do this fun stuff that you do. Your backstory is amazing. I wonder if you could just start with that. Tell our audience, how did you get it to, you know, what do you do? And how did you get to be able to do that, that somebody actually pays you to do it?
Oh my gosh, that's a circuitous story. So originally I was a professional engineer, mechanical engineer. And at the same time I was racing bikes and, really passionate about cycling, had some modest success at, you know, with a Masters Nationals and a state open sprint and kilo championship, that kind of thing, which you've heard this before. that doesn't mean I ever thought, well, I thought at one time that meant I had been good. But one dinner with Anna Mears, and you will realize that a master state championship is something you did for fun, and that's yeah. It. But anyway, I was very passionate about it, and I still am. And after I had won that title, which was sort of a big goal for me, I had always thought I wanted to go to grad school and go into academia, and so I did. But of course, I started in engineering. That's the right thing to do, right? Clean air, clean water, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so, but at the same time, my training partner from when we raced, Trey Gannon, was in one of Andy Coggins' studies at University of Texas. And through that, we ended up meeting Ed Coyle, who, you know, that was his lab. And we started having these brown bag lunches with Ed. And really cool, in retrospect, almost unbelievable. He would listen to our bikey jargon and then translate it back to us in physiology so that we would understand, you know, the training goals and that kind of thing. And that just got me so fired up. But still, engineering, that's what I am. That's what I do. One day I was at my job and I was talking to actually a geologist, Brad Wentworth, old colleague. And I was saying, you know, Brad, I know that what I'm studying is important. It's the right thing to do. But, you know, I find myself daydreaming about cycling still. I mean, I wish I could do that. But, you know, that doesn't matter. Cycling doesn't matter. If you know, what's the best case? What's the most important thing that could happen? The person I work with wins and somebody else gets second. That's not as important as clean air and clean water. And Brad sticks his hand in my face, as in stop. And he says, breakthroughs in every field have ripple effects across all other fields. Breakthroughs are made by those who are passionate about what they do. You should follow your passion. And I did. I changed majors. So,
and here we are.
Yeah, I've been at Utah since year 2000. And, you know, that's a whole nother, you know, how do I get paid to do these fund studies? That's a whole episode of its own about academia and what's important that we could go on. In fact, we should go on. I'll tell you the backstory later. But these studies, for the most part, have been done without funding. Cyclists from the local communities come in. They bust their ass for my students and me and my colleagues. And, you know, we're pursuing what we think are interesting questions. And I should add, so my lab is called the Neuromuscular Function Lab. And what we say we study is cyclical muscle contraction. We swear up and down we don't study cycling. But cycling happens to be a really good model for studying cyclical muscle contraction. So that's what we do. And the beauty of that is, since we're not studying cycling, we can go way outside of cultural norms and in that way find things that are actually really important for cycling. So, you know, for the classic example is when I studied crank length, I didn't study 167.5 versus 170 versus 172.5, which other people have done. I studied 120, 145, 170, 195, and 220. By going that big, you get a big signal-to-noise ratio and you actually get to figure things out.
But I just find it amazing that you guys are able to do this, to answer these questions, that if people are not finding your work or the derivations of your work, then they don't know. If you're relying on marketing, well, you're in trouble. Your wallet's going to be much lighter. I've thought back on all of the bikes and things that I've done to my bikes over the years, and it's a tragedy how much money I wasted, you know, for no reason, just because I was listening to the marketing material and to my buddies, who of course didn't know anything more than I did. But you're a guy who knows some stuff. So here, let's just make a list of the things that I'm interested in. I want to talk about crank length. You know, does crank length matter? How does it matter? You know, how should a person decide, you know, what kind of crank length would be, you know, right for them? You know, is it based on whatever came on my bike, which is sort of based on my height? Or is there some other way to do it? Why would it matter? Okay, cadence is kind of related to crank length. You know, as I think about these tiny little cranks, you know, that little circus song goes through my mind. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, like really, really fast, you know, cadence. So I think crank length and cadence are kind of related, but independent of the crank length, is there like an optimal cadence? You know, Lance Armstrong kind of made the high cadence stuff popular, but I think the Pro Peloton is kind of high cadence anyway, because I think it makes it easier to respond to attacks and things like that. But anyway, I'd like to know, what does the science say about that? Pedaling technique. Okay. People have argued about this since the bicycle was invented. How should you do it? Do you want to pedal perfect circles, or are you scraping your foot, you know, the Le Mans thing, or, you know, are you pulling up on the pedal to unweight it? You know, these are all things that I have been told to do. And is any of that real? Does any of that make any sense? And then the last thing that I'd like to touch on would be recommendations that you've got based on your work here for training. How could a person like me get better? What could I do that would actually make a difference? In your work, you have discovered it makes a difference for cyclists. How does that sound?
Sounds great. I think I can do it.
Awesome. Well, you're the right guy. But I wonder if you might just tell, maybe it's kind of a philosophical thing, you know, but what do you think about when you think about a bicycle? Is the bicycle person marriage, doesn't it sort of have kind of a magical feel to you? I mean, when I taught my daughters how to ride a bike, They picked it up in like 30 seconds. It was like nothing to teach a person how to ride a bicycle, especially a kid, how to ride. It's like we were designed to ride bicycles, somehow. It's kind of, and when I have ridden my bicycle, it makes me happy. My body and my brain like it. It even likes the suffering that comes with the riding of a bicycle. You know, when you get to, what did Lamont say? It never gets easier. You just go faster.
You just get faster. Yeah.
The suffering is also something. There's something about it that really appeals to me. I'd like to know what you think.
Oh, what is the human bike relationship? There's so many directions you can go there. I will give you this little anecdote. One time I was thinking, I was on a bike ride on right over here in the canyon, and I was thinking about self-selected cadence for climbing versus flats. And I started thinking about this. There's a whole field of engineering referred to as two-wheeled vehicle dynamics. The math is horribly difficult, but basically it's, why does your bike go down the road, constantly falling, but always falling, and riding, right? Righting itself. And I had this thought that, what is it about self-selected cadence and why does it change with what we're doing? It's sort of related to that. If you're an experienced cyclist and you're riding and you see somebody, I don't know, quarter mile away, you know, somehow you know if that person is a good rider. You can just tell. You don't know whether they shave their legs. You don't know what kind of equipment they're on or even their kit, but you know. And so these two thoughts are in my head. And I started thinking about two-wheel vehicle dynamics. Two-wheel vehicle dynamics have two characteristics. One is called weave frequency, and the other one is called wobble frequency. And wobble is what you don't want, and some bikes give you. Weave frequency is how it just goes down the road and steers itself. And I was thinking about that, and I wonder if good cyclists are doing a good job of matching their cadence to the weave frequency of their bike. That would make sense because you're going slower uphill, and it turns out that means the weave frequency is lower. So maybe you're synchronizing with your bike. I guess as you hinted at, maybe you have this magical relationship with your bike that you know how to be one with your bike. So I had that thought, and then in an incredible twist of fate, no sooner did I go over the top and start the descent down the other side than I saw a complete beginner on a department store bike in some teeny, teeny, tiny gear coming uphill at about 110 RPM. And I swear it looked like he was going to crash at any second. Like these just all, oh, and I'm like, okay, confirmation. There it is. This is the opposite extreme.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. But I think what you were alluding to with your daughters is, I'm trying to remember what the title is. There's a book that I tried to read and I couldn't make it all the way through. I think it's called The Mathematical Neurobiology of Pointing and Reaching. Sounds like a real thriller, huh?
Oh my gosh.
I tried to read it at bedtime like a novel, and all I ever did was go to sleep. But they make the case that everything we do, we're doing with, for the most part, we're doing with our spinal cord, not with our brain, not even with our motor cortex. We're doing it with our spinal cord. That our spinal cord has evolved movement patterns since we were our little slithering ancestors coming out of the muck, right? Mm-hmm. And that those, what we would call now spinal cord level motor programs, they know how to do things. Your daughter's spinal cord level motor programs know how to pedal a bike. They don't need to read a magazine or listen to a podcast to know how to pedal. And I think, the reason that's true, and we'll get to technique in a little while, is in each of your legs, you got 38 muscles that can push the cranks or pull the cranks. And a good number of those, I should know this off the top of my head, but less than half, but not too much less, are what we would call biarticular muscles. They span two joints. So for instance, hamstrings extend the hip, but also flex the knee. But when you're cycling, you have to simultaneously extend the knee and the hip. And so how do you use those properly? And the simple answer is you would need a supercomputer, quantum computer, to figure that out. But in fact, your spinal cord level, your spinal cord already knows. So just don't overthink it. Just go with it.
That's interesting. I bet that when we start getting into why do things matter or not matter, and what's going to come up is trying to change how you do things naturally is really hard.
Yeah, and really pointless, I would say.
Even
at
more
least
important.
In the case of pedaling. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, so I wonder, can you confirm? As I was preparing for today, I was looking up online, but you never know what you can trust there, that a human being on a bicycle is the most efficient animal on the planet. We go farther on a kilocalorie on a bike than any other animal can do. And a bird is the closest. Anyway, is that right? Do you know?
I've seen the same thing that you found. And what I remember was they were equating the cost, the dollar cost, if you took in your kilocalories in oatmeal, and they were comparing that to the cost of a gasoline car. And it was just like the difference is phenomenal. So yeah, we're very efficient because no other animals get to roll. And yeah, rolling is a very efficient way to move things.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's interesting in that, you know, we're not using all of our musculature when we're riding a bike. I mean, I suppose we have to hold ourselves up somehow, so our arms and shoulders are getting into it. But it's not like a rowing machine where it's like everything is getting employed. But I wonder if that isn't an advantage for the cyclist, because maybe you could go a little faster if you could use all your arms and all of the bigger muscles in your upper body, but you would sure get worn out in a hurry, whereas you can ride a bicycle for hundreds of miles.
Right, right. Well, yeah, submaximally for sure. And interesting that you bring that up. I've actually seen studies where they do a cycling, you know, leg only pedaling. They do a VO2 max, and then they give the research participant pedals and arm cranks. And when they do that, you know, the expectation would be, you know, now you can take up and process even more oxygen. Yeah. But in fact, VO2 max is VO2 max, and whether you're doing it with two legs or two legs and two arms typically doesn't matter.
I see. So you might be able to use more oxygen, but if you can't get it in and put it around your body, it doesn't do you any good.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, well, so let's just go through these things one at a time. I think maybe any order is fine with me, you know, the crank length, cadence, pedaling technique. But if you've got a sequence that you would prefer, let's do that.
You go right ahead.
All right. Well, let's just talk about crank length. It's kind of a thing. Some of the pros are going really short now on their cranks. You know, when I first started cycling, nobody gave it any thought. The bike came with cranks. I just used the cranks that it came with. The only time that I ever had any thought about it was when I went on the track and I was riding on the velodrome. I had to build a bike from scratch, right? Not many track bikes that you buy off the shelf. And so I had to pick my crank length. And I looked into, well, what should I do? And I ended up getting 172s and a half. On my road bike and on all my other bikes, I was 175. And later on, somebody said, oh, that's a terrible mistake. Your brain is all confused now. It, you know, that 2.5, you know, millimeters is such a difference that it will really wreck you switching back from bike to bike. So that's another question about crank length. Is longer or a shorter better? Does it depend on the person? And should a person just use the same length all the time? Because otherwise their brain's going to fall out.
Okay. Yeah. So again, sticking to the big picture and the simple answer, we've done three types of studies with crank length. We've done, you know, my starting point was maximal sprinting power, no difference across a range from 145 to 195, no significant difference. And even if you look at the means, they were within less than 2% across that, what cyclists would consider a gigantic range. And we actually did have two other links that were slightly less powerful. They were 3.9% less than the most powerful. That was 120s and 220s. So across that range, you're only seeing, you know, a few watts. Again, this is maximal sprinting. So it is remarkable how unimportant it is in maximal sprinting power. So you could choose any length you like, whether, you know, in the case of a velodrome, you don't want your up-track pedal hitting the pavement and causing you to fall, so you might want to go shorter. You might want to get really, really aero, especially if you're match sprinting or kilo riding or pursuiting, you want to get really aero, so you don't want to have your thighs hitting your torso when you get low, when you get a horizontal torso. So there again, shorter is better. But the main thing is you have the freedom to choose. It's just another bike fitting variable, like the width of your handlebars, the length of your stem. It's not going to affect your power, sprinting power. On the endurance side, which is probably where most of your listeners are, it also doesn't matter. We looked at efficiency, so the cost of doing the exercise. In simple terms, you could think of heart rate for any given power. We would be taking the VO2 for any given power. And it turns out that what matters is how fast the pedal goes around in a circle. So related to both the cadence and the crank length, those two together matter, but the crank length itself doesn't matter. So whether you're on whatever, 180s doing something relatively lower or 150s doing something relatively higher cadence, the metabolic cost and efficiency is the same. So again, feel free to choose what you want. You can stick with what you have on your bike. If aerodynamics are really important for you, you might want to consider shorter so that you can get your torso lower. You also might, in your audience, I believe your audience is aimed at healthy aging, fitness aging, cycling audience.
Yeah.
And let's face it, a lot of us have hip issues. And if you've got hip impingement, if you know you're destined in the not too distant future for a hip replacement, go to a shorter crank. Reduce your range of motion. That's how I got through the last year before my hip replacement. I was on 155s, and I was just as comfortable as could be.
That's interesting. So you're saying that the speed matters, but the length of the crank doesn't matter. So the way to interpret that is the longer crank is going to have to go faster to get around one time at the same RPMs as a shorter crank, right?
Yes. And I promise to stay away from the math. So I'm going to keep that promise. But there is something very fascinating. It turns out that when cyclists self-select cadences across crank lengths, and this actually will be important. Actually, let me take a step back. Probably most of your cyclists who have looked into changing crank lengths have seen various calculators saying, if you shorten the crank 10%, you need to, you know, reduce your chain rings by 5 teeth or, you know, 10%, whatever it might be. And it turns out that that's actually not true. And it's actually a really fascinating area. So let's stop talking about cycling for just a second, and we'll talk about showing off in the gym.
Okay, that's good. I like to do that too.
Okay, good. Yeah. You've decided you want to show off in the gym. You're trying to impress somebody. And so when you do that, I guess it depends on the audience, would you choose to do a deep, full squat, powerlifting legal squat, or would you put a lot of weight on and do a partial squat so that you've just got heaps of plates?
Sure. More weight on a less deep squat.
Yeah. So it makes you look better. So what's the difference? Why can you do more weight when you go less? And it has to do with how much of an angle your legs the range of motion that your legs go through. And the same exact thing happens, partial squat versus deep squat, same thing happens when you pedal short versus long cranks. So when you go to a short crank, most people will raise the saddle height so that the maximum extension, you know, at the bottom, the height at the bottom of the seat height, all the way down the crank to the bottom of the pedal, right? Mm-hmm. I'm saying that well. I'm sure I'm making fitters cringe with that statement. Most people keep that the same when they change crank length. And so if you've gone to a short crank, what that means is your leg is now more fully extended throughout the entire pedal stroke, except that one point at the bottom. That's where it's the same as it was. Over the top, it's more extended. At 3 o'clock, it's more extended. Only at 6 o'clock is it not more extended.
Good point.
The opposite is true when you go to a longer crank, because you go to a longer one, you'll typically drop the saddle. And so now your leg is more flexed at every point in the cycle, except the bottom. So you're doing a deep squat with a longer crank. So you decide whether you want to be less strong or not. Anyway, the point of that is these online calculators are wrong because they are assuming that the crank length, you know, it should limit the torque you produce, right, for any given muscle force. And that's true, except for the fact that you won't make the same muscle force. With a longer crank, you'll make less muscle force, and with a shorter one, you make more. And so when you go to adjust your gearing to compensate for the cranks, gearing and cadence and so forth, you only need to compensate by about half as much as the change in the length. So you go to a 10% shorter crank, go to 5% lower gearing, and it should feel the same.
How interesting. Okay, so this is sort of like, why do I stand up? And I'm climbing and my legs are kind of fatiguing, and I stand up and I can put out a lot of power because my legs are not bent nearly as much when I'm standing up.
Yeah, that's right.
Cool. All right, so crank length doesn't matter for power output, but it does matter for aerodynamics. It seemed like there's two things going on there. One is a bad thing for aerodynamics in that I'm sitting up higher on the bike. If I raise the lowest part of my foot, I have to raise where my butt sits so that my leg angle at the bottom is the same. So now I'm higher in the wind, at least my butt is. But if my knee does not come up so high, I can bend over more and I can get more aerodynamic in terms of like a flat back. Is this the point?
Yes. And I should add, so yes, both things are true. Typically, historically, you would always raise your saddle by the change in crank length. There is a lot of interest right now at the elite level in lower saddle heights for exactly the reason you just described, which is, you know, you don't want a longer leg exposed to the wind. So the jury is still out on whether that matters or not. And I'll give you the example. One time, we only did this in abstract. We didn't publish it, but my grad students and I one day hopped on the erg and we did biomechanics with our self-selected seat height and with that minus 6 centimeters. So we dropped it 6 centimeters, and we only picked 6 because the shortest guy in the lab, that's how far we could drop his before it bottomed out. So we all did the same thing. And we all hated it. We were all complaining, but it made absolutely no difference to the biomechanics, except one thing. Get this. Think about this. It only mattered for one thing. When you pedaled at your normal seat height, your ankle was slightly extended, or what we would say is plantar flexed, right? Toe down. When we lowered the saddle, they dropped their heel. And in doing so, they kept the hip and the knee were not affected by those change in heights. It was remarkable. The poster is still hanging in my lab just because it's so like, what?
So they did this without anybody telling them to do it, or even that they were aware that they did it. It was the spinal cord memory just fixing it on the fly.
Exactly right. And at one point I had a grad student. He ended up not finishing with me, but he was a fitter, and I wanted him to imagine this study. I still want to do it. Bring in a fitter, pick a fitting criteria. I don't care which one it is, Serrata, Specialized, whatever. And so get the biomechanics in that most refined position. And then just go around the clock. Go, I don't know, 1 centimeter, 2 centimeters forward on the seat, 2 centimeters back, 2 centimeters up, 2 centimeters down, and see if it actually does anything to the biomechanics. Or if, like you just said, the spinal cord adjusts. And based on that one small study that is just so fun to talk about, I think it might not matter.
Well, cool. Cadence, we've talked about that a little bit. I wanted to just ask the real question that's on my mind is, I have always been told and believed, frankly, that the higher, when Armstrong made popular this idea of a higher cadence, and he used that to win, that plus other advantages that he had come up with to win 7 Tours of France. The idea was that he was trading off heart rate for muscle, I guess, use of the muscle fibers, the harder, if he was spinning the bike, then each spin used less muscle power to get an equivalent amount of power on the bike. So I guess strength times the RPMs equals the power. So the idea was that by using less strength every pedal stroke, he saved it. And the exchange that he did was by having to turn the pedals faster, his heart rate went up. And that was a good trade as long as he was trained for a high heart rate. Is that true or is that not right?
There's elements there that are true. So first things first, if I give you a set of dumbbells and ask you to do an arm curl with each dumbbell, when you do the lightest one, you'll do it almost entirely with the slow twitch muscle fibers you have in your biceps, for instance. As we go up in load, you will start to recruit more and more fast twitch fibers. The reason that's important is because slow twitch fibers are much more metabolically efficient than fast twitch fibers. They're more fatigue resistant, and they're just simply more efficient in terms of how much oxygen do they take to do a certain amount of work. So transfer that over to the high cadence thing, and you nailed it. Less force on the pedal means that you can do it with slow twitch fibers and avoid using the fast twitch fibers. Now, it won't hold forever, and it won't hold at really high powers, but I think the reasoning is there. Yeah, and you said heart rate. We need a chalkboard for this. you're right. You're right. When you pedal faster, it does cause a higher heart rate, causes a higher VO2. But
it's complicated, huh?
You're really making this hard for me you're making it hard for me to keep it simple. There's two factors. One, in my world, this is called the cost of unloaded cycling. And that reflects what is the oxygen cost just to move your legs. Okay. And we don't actually measure it with no load. Like, we don't take the chain off because that's a different task. We do it with extending a line and linear regression and all that mathematics stuff. So cost of unloaded cycling, and that goes up with higher cadence for sure. That's well established. But then the other thing is what's called delta efficiency. And that is to say, if I go from pedaling at 150 watts to pedaling at 200 watts, I don't care what the cadence is, but we're going to hold it constant. Then how much did that go up? How much did the oxygen cost go up when you went from 150 to 200 watts, for instance? Mm-hmm. And it turns out, so this will kind of give you a headache. Cost of unload cycling goes up with cadence. Delta efficiency goes down, also goes up with cadence. In other words, the change in cost goes down. So, mm-hmm. so that, and ultimately you care about the two things at once. And so it ends up being a fairly weak relationship with a fairly, you know, generous band where you're pretty much in the noise.
Okay. Well, so I wonder another thing that is related here, even if we got rid of the, maybe the heart rate doesn't go up by much by pedaling faster. One of the advantages of pedaling faster is that when you say there's an attack or something on the road, for you to respond to it going at a higher cadence, you need less force per pedal stroke to up your watts to match the acceleration of whoever is going away from you and not allowing you to stay in their draft. Versus if you're pedaling slowly, it's a huge amount of effort to, you know, essentially out of the saddle, maximum effort to try to draw them back in. And that's fine if that's one time in an hour. But if it's over and over again, you're worn out from that. So yeah. The higher cadence seems like it's a safer way to go, even if there is a slight metabolic disadvantage from it.
Exactly right. So there is a parabolic relationship. In other words, your maximum power for most people on average is somewhere around 120, 125. RPM on regular cranks. Hmm. And so if you were at a really efficient cadence, let's just say, you know, Graham O'Bree at 80 RPM for his hour record, then you would be really bogged down and you would have low maximum power when you started trying to get that wheel like you just described. If you were up at 90, maybe 100 RPM, then it'd be much easier to respond because at that cadence, your power is higher. You're closer to your optimal cadence, and it's easier to close that gap quickly.
All right. So anyway, that's useful for me. Hopefully the audience will take that into their calculations. Let's move on to this like pedaling technique question, which is like the biggest boogeyman that I ever encountered. I have a partner on the podcast, Glenn, who has moved to South Korea, amazingly. That's his heritage. And so he's like 12 hours away. And so he has found it difficult to get up at 3 a.m. to do podcasts with me lately. But he was a very successful amateur as well as master cyclist. I think he was like 7-time master world champion on the bike in various disciplines. So anyway, he knew what he was talking about. He thought he knew the best way to pedal a bike, that there was a best way to pedal a bike. He's going to be rolling over in his grave and he isn't even dead yet. Tell us about pedaling technique.
All right. So yeah, he probably, the thing about these techniques that you'll read about in magazines and books and you get advice from coaches, the two studies that have been done, and one of them I'm on, they show that if you give someone instructions about how to pedal, you know, pull up, pedal a circle, push down, emphasize what, you know, whatever it might be, the cyclist can do that. They can, in fact, follow those instructions. They can change their power or their biomechanics. Now, the studies that have then had metabolic cost or efficiency, right, heart rate, VO2, the studies that have also measured that with technique have both shown that when you change from your self-selected technique to something else, pulling up or pedaling circles, both I think are, and in our case, the pedaling circles involved scraping the mud and kicking over the top. Those were the instructions. And when you do that, your metabolic cost, so your heart rate or your VO2, goes up by about 10 or 11%, not down. Your efficiency goes down, metabolic cost goes up compared to your self-selected.
For the same power?
Yes, for the same power.
Wow, that's bad.
When those papers first came out, I clearly had too much time on my hands because I would spend time on slowtwitch.com quite a bit. And, you know, naturally that study finds its way into social media, and I would get ripped on Slow Twitch. I would get hate mail in my email. You don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, you told them to do it and they could do it, but that didn't mean they knew how to do it. Oh. If you'd given them practice, then they would have developed that technique and they would have been much better, like me, you know, or whatever. And so, okay, fine. It's true. The two studies that I'm talking about, they were acute interventions. They came into the lab. We said, do this. They did that. And their metabolic cost went up. Would they have gotten better with practice? We don't know. We didn't do that. So fast forward several years, and there happened to be a Paralympic cyclist that rides the same canyon that I ride. And he's completely single-legged. Think about this guy. If you've been riding for 7 years, as he had, with one leg, you probably know how to pedal in a circle. You probably know how to pull up.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you can't not.
Right.
Not know how. And so one thing and another, and he came into my lab, and we had him pedal as he normally would, you know, with an empty crank on the amputated side. And his efficiency was pretty bad. His metabolic cost was pretty high. In fact, it was very similar to the cyclists when they're told to pull up or pedal in a circle, the other cyclists. And then we did, in my lab, I think you alluded to single leg at one point. We do single leg cycling, but when we do it, it's not about pulling up or pedaling circles. And in fact, we do our best to minimize that by putting a counterweight on the other pedal. So we put about 20 pounds over there. And that allows you to pedal not exactly the same as you always would, but much, much, much closer in terms of you don't have to pull up. And so we put this on for him. And he starts pedaling. And immediately, his metabolic cost went down, his efficiency went up by about 10 or 11%. Wow. And he has had 7 years to learn the technique of pulling. He didn't need any time to learn the technique of just pushing. and his efficiency went up right away. And so, I mean, that to me, that is maybe the most important pedaling technique study ever. And in fact, you know, in academia, you typically have to use kind of dry language in peer-reviewed publications. We wrote towards the end of this paper, we wrote, we believe this is the final nail in the coffin on the argument of pedaling technique.
Funny.
Of course, it's not. It wasn't, but it should be.
Yeah. Well, so are you saying that whatever comes naturally to you is the best? I'm not sure what you're saying exactly.
Yeah. When you pedal, when your daughter pedaled, when you first got her going on training wheels or whatever, she was relying on spinal cord level motor programs that know how to coordinate the 38 muscles in your two legs, well, 76 muscles in your two legs that can extend and flex the leg. And you aren't smart enough to outdo your spinal cord. It's way too complicated.
Wow.
So as soon as you start trying to change it, you overthink it and you mess it up. And maybe the most beautiful study on this, there's a guy at University of Calgary named Walter Herzog. He is the absolute guru of really, really basic muscle mechanics. And I won't bore you with that, but he did a really simple study once that nobody else I could imagine thinking of this. He did maximum isometric pedaling contractions. So imagine you start at, well, let's just say you're at 3 o'clock. He locked the pedals at 3 o'clock and he said, push as hard as you can.
Okay.
And the cyclist did. And then he said, push as hard as you can, but be very conscious to push perpendicular to the crank so that all your force is producing torque.
Okay.
And so, not surprisingly, they couldn't push quite as hard. But here's the beautiful finding. When you look at the force vectors and so forth, you find that when they just pushed without regard to direction, they produced more torque than they did when they were given the instruction to produce as much torque as you can.
Yeah, there's your proof.
And I think that's because, yeah, it's just so elegant.
Yeah, your spinal cord knows how to do it. Don't get in the way. I mean, that probably doesn't mean you don't need to strengthen your muscles and get a bike that fits and all of these other things that matter. But in terms of, like, you know, which muscles to engage when around the clock, don't mess yourself up with that.
That's right. That's right.
Anybody who has got a, you know, like serving a tennis ball or, you know, a complicated act that has taken them years to learn, the more they think about it when they're doing it, they can't do it. It falls apart on them.
Beautiful. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So let's keep moving here. Now, the last bit on the pedaling technique that I'm not sure I fully understand, and that's this business of everybody's a little different, right? I mean, my spinal cord is different from yours. And when I do what feels right to me, which is different from how what you do, what feels right to you, we have a difference in our muscle usage, which muscles are being employed when. And you had done a study where you were measuring sort of the relative dominance of quad-focused pedaling versus glute-focused pedaling. I'm not sure how to say that exactly, but you found a difference. I'm not sure if it was in the power or it was just in the endurance, but you did find a difference. But you found that people could not be trained to get better, but you did find a way to make people better?
Okay. Yeah. Let me go back, leave my lab, and go actually, interestingly enough, back to Ed Coyle's lab at UT Austin. In 2021, Brian Leary was doing his PhD with Ed. And Ed has long, long, long held this belief that the more experienced, you know, pro riders, he knows that they produce more peak pedal torque than local riders, even when they're pedaling at the same power. That paper is 1991. Okay, so 30 years in between when he first got this idea that the reason their peak is higher is because they're using larger muscle mass from the hip. And he's touted this, he's written review articles, but he never had data until this Brian Leary came along. And Brian did what must have been a mind-boggling amount of work in the lab. And what he ended up with was two groups of cyclists who had the same lactate thresholds when they ran uphill on a treadmill.
Okay.
And that's a pretty similar task to pedaling. And so what you take away from that is, well, they have about the same fitness. But then when they cycled, about half of them had fairly low lactate thresholds. In other words, they're not going to have a lot of fitness at this. And the other had very high lactate thresholds. So what were they doing differently? And he took, in addition to, you know, the lactate threshold, he was also taking the biomechanics. And what he found was that the group who had the higher lactate threshold were utilizing their hip muscles more. And that's important because, you know, the muscles that span the hip are larger, or at least in conjunction with the knee muscles, they're certainly much larger. And I don't know if it was before you hit record or not, but you made the comment about rowing versus cycling. And so those of your audience who occasionally will get on a Concept 2 erg will know that for any given heart rate, their lactates aren't very high. In fact, they're really low when you row compared to when you cycle. And the reason for that is because you have much more muscle mass involved. And so you think of it the way I say it is, you're spreading the work around to a larger muscle mass. And so what that means is that any given muscle or any given muscle fiber is going to be less stressed than if it was a very small muscle mass. So these high lactate threshold riders were intuitively using more of a hip extension action. So, okay, now let's think about that, but in conjunction with the paper showing that you shouldn't tell someone how to pedal. Okay. So we were scratching our heads saying, okay, how can we increase hip extension or, well, hip action, mostly extension, without saying anything about pedaling? And so this was part of Ernie Reimer's dissertation in my lab. We brought cyclists in. They pedaled without saying anything about technique. So we're going to get your biomechanics, and that's all. Just pedal, you know, just do 250 watts. And they could, of course. And then we said, okay, now we want you to reduce the amount of weight that's being supported by your hands. And the reason that was our cue is because the muscular action that will lift up your torso, and by the way, they didn't change positions. They didn't sit up straight. They stayed on the hooks or on the drops. Mm-hmm. They just simply put less weight on the bars, and we measured the weight on the bars. And when they reduced the weight, following our instruction, they could do it. And the way they did it was to dramatically increase the amount of the work done by the hip extension action. A lot of biomechanics in there. The simple fact is that they were able to follow an instruction that had nothing to do with pedaling technique and change their pedaling technique.
The spinal cord figured it out.
Yeah, the spinal cord did. It knows how to do it. So we think that this is what was going on with these two groups that Leary had. Some of them leaned heavily on their handlebars. Some of them didn't. You know, I've had a lot of conversations about this with friends and former teammates and other cyclists. And one of my former teammates from way back, the guy is now in his early 60s, and he's placing in open Cat 3.
Wow.
I'll just let that sit there. Yeah. I mean, the guy is just a hard man cyclist. Because I knew he was racing. As soon as I got these results, I called him up and said, you know, hey, you can't name people. Mm-hmm. Hey, buddy, you know, we just found this. And he goes, it's interesting you say that because, you know, my hands never go to sleep. I've never had my hands go to sleep.
That's telling, my God.
Yeah. So his intuitive technique was to lever up his torso. Never had his hand go to sleep. That kind of makes me mad.
Yeah. When I hear that. Exactly.
Or jealous, I guess is the right word.
Well, but there's a clue. If you're having nerve compression problems in your hands and you're having trouble working the levers because your hands are dead, you're putting too much weight on your hands. It's not a glove problem. And as a result, you're not using your muscles properly.
Or optimally. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And in fact, you know, in the paper it's in review, but in the paper we wrote, there's a whole section in the discussion on what you're talking about, nerve compression in the hands, called cyclist palsy. Hmm. It's so common in cyclists that that's what physicians refer to it as, cyclist palsy.
That's funny.
And you know, what do they prescribe? They prescribe padded glove, extra bar tape, pads under the bar tape, or maybe don't lean on your hands.
You know? Exactly. So exactly. This is great. This is great. Okay. So last thing then, right. Training advice that you can give to people, you know, whether it's from your own years of experience or what you've learned in these studies that seem to really make a difference, you know, people could try for themselves.
Yeah. Two of those. And we talked about them earlier. So the first one is, we've done a lot of work in this area. We refer to it as single leg cycling, but it is not, you know, all caps, N-O-T, not a pedaling technique thing. It's not unclipping and now working your hip flexors and all that.
Right. You're not trying to learn how to pedal in circles.
100% not. You are not doing that. Instead, if you're in our lab, we put a counterweight on there that balances it out so that you can retain your normal pedaling. And more recently, we've shown that if we simply give the instruction, we say, for the next 5 minutes, leave your left leg passive and, emphasize your right leg. We call that single leg emphasis. And we did that study in speed skaters who do a lot of cycling training, and they were able to do about three quarters of the work with the emphasized leg. Hmm. And so what that does, and let's go to the example of the counterweight. Okay, so you're sitting on a stationary bike in my lab with a counterweight on one pedal and you're pedaling with the other one. Why would you do that? The reason you would do that is because you have a central capacity to deliver oxygenated blood to your working muscles. Your heart and lungs define how much oxygen you can send. Now, when you do double leg cycling, you are dividing that central capacity up in half and giving half to each leg. Okay? And so your legs, they have no reason to adapt to be able to process any more oxygen than half of your VO2 max. There's no reason.
Right.
They're never going to see it. Mitochondria are actually metabolically expensive to maintain. And so there's no reason for them to have extra mitochondria or extra capillary density, the two things that determine how much oxygen your muscles can take up. So, but if now you pedal with one leg, now you're sending that entire capacity to deliver oxygenated blood to one leg. Now that leg thinks that you are a completely untrained novice, and it tries to adapt as if you'd never set cleat on a bike before. And that's what happens. Every study that's ever been done using single leg as a model shows just remarkable adaptations. The problem historically has been that you have to have a fancy cycle ergometer. They've done them, the way that people have done this, in my lab's pretty simple with the counterweight. Other labs have had one cyclist pedal the right crank with his left leg while another cyclist is pedaling the left crank with his right leg so that the thing is still balanced. They've used servo motors. They've used fixed gears with heavy flywheel, you name it. But you don't have that option on your bike ride, and who wants to sit in front of a Zwift if you don't have to?
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to, because you can go out and you can say, okay, I'm on my favorite sort of easy climb. It's 4% for the next several miles. For the next 5 minutes, I'm going to do my right leg, not unclipping my left leg, just relaxing my left leg. And then for the next 5 minutes after that, I'm just going to change back and forth. And this will send your, what we would call muscle respiratory capacity, just absolutely through the roof. There's so many ways to do this and take advantage of it. For instance, you're on a bike ride with someone who's not as fit as you. You're kind of grumpy about that because you're not getting a good workout. Well, just ride emphasizing one leg. And don't tell that person you're doing it, by the way, because they'll be offended. But you can get a fabulous workout going along with someone who's less fit than you if you simply do single leg emphasis. So that will improve your muscle respiratory capacity truly at an unbelievable level. That's one training tip.
Okay.
Be aware that this is super stressful, and you don't want to jump in and just start killing yourself with that, because you can really put yourself in the toilet with this.
Oh.
Gently step into it. Do not kill yourself right off the bat.
Okay.
Do a little bit at a time. A little bit goes a long way.
Okay, good tip.
Okay, so that's one training technique. And then the other one has to do with the unweighting. And that is what we do on what I've been doing and what a bunch of my friends that I talk to have been doing. The simplest way to say unweight your hands, that gets kind of complicated. Oh, how do I do that? What am I supposed to do? So my coaching tip is ride with your elbows so loose they're floppy. Your elbows have to be floppy. If your elbows are floppy, then you know that you're levering up your torso and you're using a lot of hip extension action. So if you put those two things together, you're going to have, you know, really high muscle respiratory capacity, and you're going to have really good muscle mass recruitment. I won't say technique, high muscle mass recruitment that will make your cycling life faster, more easier, more easy, and more fun.
Awesome. Oh, those are great tips. There's something related to the eccentric motion, the sort of like weighting, the lengthening of the muscle. I think that that was what causes the DOMS. It's more damaging to the muscle. But I think that you had said it in one thing that it created a tremendous training effect.
Yeah, that's right. And but before I go there, let me go back one step.
Okay.
I do squats in the winter. And so when I come out and start riding in the spring, I've actually got a really strong core and back extension muscles. And when you do that, the floppy elbows are really easy. Mm-hmm. You don't even notice. Interestingly, in one of the recent interviews, one of the comments was, I should go find it, but I'm pretty sure I can get very close to quoting. The guy said, I tried this yesterday and it was so hard on my back and my torso that I couldn't do it for a couple of minutes. This whole podcast is BS. And I've resisted the urge to say, maybe you should train your core strength. So okay. I just wanted to finish that part.
Yeah,
so I think, yes, it actually will be hard to do floppy elbows if you don't have good core strength.
Yeah.
If you do, it is easy and you'll have a great time. Now, eccentric cycling. Yes, it is the eccentric motion that does make your muscle sore, that gives you DOMS. And I could go into the molecular biology of that, but I will not do that. The simple fact is that when you get sore, that means that you've torn some certain things within your muscle. And when those get torn, they send genetic signals saying, hey, we weren't strong enough for this task. Guys, send us some more muscle mass. And so that's why you get stronger. One of my buddies, his partner just took up CrossFit. And he said, you know, find something positive to say to her about how sore she is, because she's really not sure she wants to stick with this. And I thought about it. And what I finally came up with is DOMS is just like that email you get after you order something on Amazon. It's saying your order for stronger muscles has been received and we will ship within 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah. So it's not immediate, but it will come.
Yeah. And now here's the thing. Yes, we do eccentric cycling in my lab. That requires a very, very special ergometer. It is extremely dangerous to do eccentric cycling because if you inadvertently lock out your knee, you're in deep trouble. When that motor pushes the pedal back and hyperextends your knee and sends you to the hospital. So you don't, do not take this lightly. But you can do other things that will give you the same benefit by simply doing box jumps, and not necessarily the way CrossFitters would. They would jump off of a box and then do this massive, spring type action. You can do that, and that's good. But also, if all you do is jump off the box and land, and sometimes you land with a lot of compliance, a lot of flexion as you go down, and sometimes you land somewhat rigidly, both have advantages. Both will make you sore, but I think the risk of injury is a lot less, but not zero. You can still get injured. But it's that eccentric action that's going to, place your order for stronger muscles.
I see. And would like running or walking downhill have a similar kind of an effect?
It certainly can. You don't have to be in the gym jumping off those boxes. You could go to a park and jump off a picnic table or off a bench. Anything you want to do, I would say, yeah, walking downhill, running downhill, you can do that. But I would advise for cycling that you do more of just a drop jump.
I got you.
That looks more like the position you're in when you cycle.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Jim, these were my questions. If you don't have anything you'd like to throw into this because I wasn't smart enough to ask. Then let's wrap up by you telling our audience how they can find you, your website, your, you know, whatever you've got, where people can maybe ask questions or get more information.
Oh, gosh. Well, I really do not have the social media presence that I should have. I don't have a place you can go and download or a place where all my various interviews are listed. I should have that. But probably if you Google my name and a topic of interest, you know, if you Google Jim Martin and Crank Length, you'll probably find some things. Yeah, I probably need to have a Twitter account. I don't actually have one. Yeah, or look me up at the University of Utah. Send me an email. Or Google Scholar. If you go on Google Scholar and, you know, type J.C. Martin and whatever is your topic of interest, and you'll find some papers probably.
Cool. All right. Well, hey, Jim, thank you very much. This has been really amazing. I'm going to employ some of this stuff immediately and the rest of it eventually. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
You have a good night and enjoy your warm Christmas.
Yeah. Alternative Christmas activities.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. Jim Martin. You can find more information about Dr. Martin in the show notes.